and verses 19 to 22. Ecclesiastes 7, and I'll begin reading at verse 19, but let me say a very few things briefly by way of introduction. That verses 19 go together seems evident in that 20 starts with 4. So you have a statement of 19 and then a 4 in verse 20, and then you have the same thing repeated in verses 21 and 2. You have 21, also do not take to heart, and then 4, verse 22. Now that all four verses relate to one another is somewhat evident in that, first of all, they have the same theme, that is wisdom. And then you find also that verse 21 begins also. So there's an evident connection on some level with the previous verses. So we're going to look at these four verses under these two heads. We have the strength of wisdom, verses 19 and 20, and then an example of it in verses 21 and 2. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 19. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. For there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. Also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. Solomon is continuing his teaching on wisdom, and we find, first of all, in verses 19 and 20, is strength. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. As a city where the strong ruler is safe, how much more would the city be safe if it was ruled or governed by 10 rulers? Well, wisdom strengthens or protects the wise more than this. Solomon asserts that wisdom protects, strengthens, and or protects the wise as 10 rulers would protect a city. Verse 20, for there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. That is, wisdom is necessary to protect the soul given the fact that it's in a wicked world. Remember, we've seen on a number of occasions Solomon's phrase, life under the sun. Well, life under the sun is a dangerous place. And thus we need wisdom to protect the soul. There's not a man on earth who by nature is righteous. Solomon obviously isn't denying that there's righteous people on the earth. He's simply asserting there's no one righteous by nature. Basically the same thing that Paul asserts back in Romans 3, if you remember. There's no one righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There's none who seeks after God, etc. That is, there isn't any one righteous on earth by nature. So we have a very clear affirmation in verse 20 of what we call universal or total depravity. All men are by nature born depraved. There's not one born good save one, and that's Jesus. So I think the principle here is this. Nothing protects the soul in a fallen and foolish world like wisdom. Or maybe I can re-put it this way. We need wisdom to protect our soul in a fallen and foolish world. Now, I want to briefly consider that principle with the help of two questions. Question number one, how does wisdom strengthen the wise? Well, we have to start with a brief definition of wisdom. Ordinarily, we define it, and it's not a bad definition, as the ability to practically or rightly apply knowledge. And that's not a bad definition of wisdom. It's a good one. But remember how Solomon does it, especially in the book of Proverbs. He actually speaks of wisdom more broadly. He actually speaks of wisdom as a synonym for true religion. In fact, if you remember back in verse 18, he exhorts us to get the fear of God. Because if we get the fear of God, we're going to escape all of the dangers that he's described in the previous verses. In other words, if you have the fear of God, you'll be protected. You'll be strengthened. You'll be preserved from all manner of harm in a world that's filled with a bunch of foolish, wicked sinners. If you remember how he put it again in the beginning of Proverbs, that wisdom is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So if you put all that together, by wisdom is meant a right understanding of the truth and yes, the ability to thusly apply it. A wise person understands who he is by nature, who he is by grace. A wise person understands that this world is fallen and foolish. A wise person understands sin, righteousness, etc. A wise person understands how and why to avoid it. Or we can put it this way, a wise person fears God. A wise person has understanding of true and saving religion. Wisdom is often put, especially in the Proverbs, as the opposite of folly. In contrast to a fool, a wise person has true understanding. So there's foolish people, there's wise people. And so a wise person has understanding, which in part means he no longer trusts himself, and he knows where to find strength, and that's in Christ. And this is how he gets strength. A wise person no longer looks to themselves for strength, but looks outside themselves for strength in Christ. Furthermore, true wisdom not only knows where to look for it, but also to rightly and practically apply it. This is how wisdom protects the soul. Or again, in the language of verse 19, strengthens the wise. True wisdom provides strength because the wise know where to look for strength. Or, again, in the book of Proverbs especially, wisdom is often personified and is none other than Christ himself. So we can say Christ strengthens the wise because that's where we get strength from. Where do we get protection from? But from our king, who's wiser and more powerful than 10 rulers. He protects the city of Zion, which is comprised of individual cities, if you will, individual souls. Thus, wisdom provides strength in that the wise know where to find strength and how to utilize it. Again, ultimately, this is in Jesus. Now, I have several texts to illustrate it, and let's start with Proverbs 3. Proverbs 3 doesn't use the word wisdom, but it definitely speaks of it. Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your understanding. This is the wise man. He trusts in God and he doesn't trust in himself. He shuns the foolish statement, believe in yourself, trust yourself. No, he doesn't believe in himself nor trust himself. And the reason, in part, is because there's not a man in the earth who by nature is good. He knows that he was bad in full and continues to be bad in part. Why would you trust your own foolish heart? Foolish heart in part, at least, if you're Christian. And then in verse 6, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he, wisdom, shall direct your path. So this is how and why the wise are strengthened by wisdom, because they don't look to themselves but to him. Wisdom strengthens the wise because they know where not to look for it and they know where to look for it. All right. How about chapter 4? You have several texts. I'm just going to give you a sample. Start at verse 5. Get wisdom, get understanding. You find those synonymous. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will preserve you. Love her, she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. And in all you're getting, get understanding. Exalt her, and she will promote you. See, she's going to protect you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. She will place on your head an ornament of grace, a crown of glory. She will deliver you. Wisdom is the principal thing because wisdom strengthens the wise. She protects us from this wretched world. How about maybe one more text? Jump ahead to chapter 24, verse 5. 24:5. A wise man is strong. Yes, a man of knowledge increases strength. How does he increase strength? He doesn't increase strength because he looks in himself. Remember how Paul put it, who was a wise man, in 2 Corinthians 12. When we're weak, then we're strong. Verse 6. For by wise counsel you will wage your own war, and in a multitude of counselors there's safety. So he looks to the scriptures, and he looks to wise men. He looks to counselors. He doesn't look to himself. He doesn't think himself wise. He knows, in fact, by nature he isn't. That's a wise man. A wise man is like a strong man. A strong man knows he isn't strong, but knows he's weak. A wise man knows he isn't wise. He doesn't trust in his own understanding. He doesn't lean upon his own abilities. He looks outside himself. And that does include looking to people who are wiser. A wise man takes heed of counsel, but a fool runs headlong against it. Philip Ryken put it like this. The preacher, that is Solomon, imagines a city governed by a council of 10. Most cities would be fortunate to have even one wise leader to protect the city, but there is strength in numbers. And this particular city has 10 good rulers to govern its civil affairs. A wise person has the strength of a well-governed city. Wisdom governs thought. So the wise person knows how to think about things in a God-centered way. Wisdom governs the will. So the wise person knows what choices to make in life. Wisdom governs speech. So the wise person knows what to say and not to say. Wisdom governs action. So the wise person knows what to do in any and every situation. Take hold of wisdom, and it will make you strong. Again, our text, wisdom strengthens the wise. Question 2. Why are the wise in need of strength? Well, the answer is rather evident, and it's found in verse 20. Our soul is a battlefield. Our soul is a battlefield. Or perhaps to alter the imagery slightly, we are behind enemy lines, and to make matters worse, we have a traitor within. And we saw the identity of this traitor Sunday last. That's called the flesh. I think that's how you relate verse 20 to verse 19. You need strength, and you need it in wisdom or from wisdom, because there's no wisdom native to man, and man by nature is very wretched and very foolish. You're living in a dangerous world. And to make matters worse, the greatest enemy or foe lies within. John Bunyan, who we hope to consider God willing this Sunday, wrote an allegorical work entitled Holy War. We'll look at it briefly in our Sunday school, God willing. He's most known for other allegorical works, like Pilgrim's Progress, but Holy War actually was a very well-received and popular treatise in his day. It's basically an allegory of a town called Mansoul, which was originally ruled by God, a benevolent king, but is overtaken by the devil, and eventually is recovered by Emmanuel. And then after Emmanuel recovers Mansoul, the battle begins. And the book describes in very allegorical but graphic imagery how it is or why it is that we need to be strengthened. because we have enemies. Enemies without and enemies within. That brings us then to verse 21 and 2. And I think, again, it relates to the previous verses in that he's continuing the theme of wisdom. So the also does go back to verse 19 and 20, but it really just goes back to the whole previous context. Also, i.e. we're on the same point of wisdom. Do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. I think this is in part an example of why we need wisdom to be strengthened in a world that's filled with foolish people. Stallman provides a benefit, perhaps we can say, or a practical expression of wisdom. And there's an exhortation of verse 21 and then a reason, verse 22. Notice the exhortation, do not take to heart everything people say. I think the basic meaning here is this. Don't be overly fixated or concerned with what people think and say about you. That's what it means to take it to heart. Don't take it to heart. Don't be weighed down with it. Don't be burdened by it. Don't be overly concerned with it. To take something to heart is to take it seriously. To be concerned about it and perhaps even perplexed by it. Because as soon as you begin to take it to heart, Solomon says, you're going to hear it everywhere, even if you imagine it or not. Don't take everything you hear so seriously about you, because otherwise you're going to hear it everywhere, and sometimes you're even going to imagine it. I think we all know people that, maybe some of us are like that. We think everybody's out to get us. We think everybody's talking about us just because maybe they looked at us oddly. Oh, I really believe that brother has an issue with me. Why? I saw it the way he looked at me. See, you're taking it to heart. You're so fixated on it, you're imagining it. But I don't think that he's predominantly speaking about imagination. I think he's saying if you keep looking for it, you're going to find it. Even those close to you, your servants, you're going to find them cursing you. To curse is to speak against. Belcher, let me give you two contemporary commentators' thoughts. Belcher, if someone is overly concerned with what people are saying, the likelihood increases that they will hear something negative said about them, even from someone fairly close to them. Don't be hypersensitive with reference to what people are saying. I'm going to put a little clarification on that in a moment. But this is what he's saying. Philip Ryken, if we have to know what to hear and what to ignore, especially when it comes to criticism, says we have to know what to hear and what to ignore, especially when it comes to criticism. This is one of the ways that wisdom makes us strong. It helps us not to be overly concerned about what other people say. It teaches us not to take offense, but to respond with gentleness and grace, even when the things that people say may seem unfair. Now, the reason why we're not, in part, not to take such criticism too seriously or to heart is given in verse 22. For many times also, your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. If you're going to be very honest about it, everybody struggles because there's not a person on earth who's righteous and doesn't sin. And again, that means we're all sinners by nature. And even as Christians, we stumble in many things. Probably, I would think most Christians stumble in sins of the tongue and particularly criticism of others as much as any other sin. But if you stop and think about it, brethren, this is a sin perhaps we don't think about often. It's the violation of the ninth commandment. Being hypercritical of others. And in order to combat that, Solomon says, remember how often you tend to do the same thing. Don't be a hypocrite. to be straightforward, brethren, I've noticed this. Oftentimes, those who are hypercritical are hypersensitive. That's doubly bad, because not only are you sinning and being hypercritical, but now you're sinning and being a hypocrite. I've noticed that those who slander most are most sensitive about being slandered. I think everybody's slandering me. But every time I talk to you, you slander somebody. It's kind of the thing that is sadly true of us, isn't it? We tend to condemn in others that which we do. This is what Solomon is addressing. When you're tempted to respond to hypercriticism in a high-handed way, be mindful of the fact that you probably are guilty of the same sin. The principle obviously can be applied to any sin, but he's thinking particularly of the sin of hypercriticism. Don't be so quick to be offended at what others say about you, because if you're going to be honest, you probably say the same things about them. Brother, stop and think about that. That's kind of straightforward, isn't it? Solomon is taking the gloves off here. How often are you guilty of the same sins you condemn in others? This is what Solomon is saying. Martin Luther agrees with my assessment. Some people are so curious about their reputation that they pay close attention to every word and every nod of every person. They listen at windows and cracks in the walls to find out what someone is saying about them. It serves such people right if they hear something about their family that causes them grief. Therefore, he says, if you want to give ear to what everyone is saying, you will have to expect to hear even your own people cursing you. There's no need to reach out curiously for what everybody's saying, nor should you immediately lose your temper and seize your weapon on this account. You should rather overlook it, for you too have committed many similar sins against others. Don't quickly reach for your weapons. Overlook it, because you too probably have been guilty of similar sins. All right, so that's a quick overview of the passage. Let's give three observations in a few minutes here. Observation number one, we need to be willing to receive criticism. And here, in the first place, I'm speaking about unjust criticism. And the reason why we're to receive, overlook, endure unjust criticism is told us in verse 22. Well, it's actually told us in verse 20 and 22. There's not a righteous person on earth, and that includes you, and you're probably guilty of the same thing. See, brethren, we tend to be awful quick, don't we? And I'm going to qualify here in a moment. There are times when you have to defend yourself. But we tend to be very quick to our weapons, to use Luther's imagery. The Lord knows, those who have sense know, and at the end of the day, who else really matters? People can talk about me, they can criticize me all they want. Those who know me best know it's not true. God knows it's not true. So why do I have to defend myself? Leave it at that. And in the end, all things will be worked out. But here I'm also thinking that a lot of times criticism has at least some truth to it. And perhaps is fully true. Again, the difficulty is that we don't like to be criticized, and it's difficult sometimes to endure it. Brethren, I don't think this verse justifies us ignoring all criticism. The mindset that says, I couldn't care less what people say or think of me, isn't fully biblical. There is a sliver of truth to it. But the mindset, usually when people have the mindset, I don't care what people think, I don't care what people do, that tends to be a justification for being an untouchable. We have to always be willing to humbly endure criticism and ransack it, look through it, and honestly determine whether or not there's any truth to it. We have to be humble. We have to be humble enough to admit, because of remaining sin, we all stumble in many, if not most, ways. And again, verse 20 and 22 teaches us this. We're all by nature, verse 20, born wicked sinners. And we all remain, even after grace, verse 22, potential wicked sinners. And because of that, we have to be open to criticism. Brother and sister, a person who's not open to it denies the reality of verse 20 and 22. It's pride. Do you really think that you're above criticism? Do you really think that you are above the possibility of needing correction? There's but one person who is beyond any just criticism, and he's in heaven. Everybody else on earth is fair game. Observation number two. We need to learn, and this is going to seem in contrast to the first, but we need to learn how to ignore criticism. I think that's the main point of the terms. This simply means that there is some criticism that needs to be disregarded. And this, of course, is going to be true of every Christian. Every Christian is going to have to endure unjust criticism. There's going to always be people who talk about you and unjustly criticize you. And here's the reasons, verse 20 and verse 22. Because we're all by nature wicked, and after grace we remain to be potentially so. People are judgmental and jealous. It's just the way it is. And oftentimes, these vices of judgment, being judgmental and jealous, will make themselves known in a hypercritical spirit. We're all, according to verse 22, potentially guilty of it. For many times also, your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. Spurgeon once said, every minister needs to have one blind eye and one deaf ear. A blind eye to overlook offenses and a deaf ear to ignore unjust criticism. In fact, in his lectures to his students, which were given on Friday afternoons, there's a lecture on criticism. I can't remember the exact title of the lecture. It's about halfway in to the lectures. And it's really an exposition of this text, a loose exposition of this text. Well, actually, it's an excellent exposition of this text, Ecclesiastes 7 and 21. And in part, he says this, a minister ought to have one blind eye and one deaf ear. By the way, somewhere else I couldn't find it. I think it's in that lecture. He also says he wished he could give every one of his students three things. One blind eye, one deaf ear, and a hole in his pocket. But I couldn't find the latter one, so we're stuck with the first two. This is what he says. A part of my meaning is expressed in plain language by Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes. Also take no heed unto the words spoken to you. The margin says, give not thy heart to all words spoken. Do not take them, and then he's going to give his little quick exposition of it, or definition of that statement. Do not take them to heart, or let them weigh with you. Do not notice them, or act as if you heard them. You cannot stop people's tongues, and therefore the best thing is to stop your own ears, and never mind what's spoken. Thus, we have to ask ourselves this question: is the belief or practice for which I'm criticized a biblical truth, or is it a belief or practice that results from a biblical principle? If so, let criticism continue. Remember the first point, we have to examine ourselves, or we have to at least be humble enough to scrutinize all criticism. But we have to be wise enough to know what to take to heart and what not. We have to hear some with our good ear and ignore the others with our bad ear. Criticism. He shouldn't do it that way. He should do it this way. Why do they do it that way and not this way? Well, let me hear your thoughts. Okay, well, here's why we do it this way. The Bible says so. And this is why we don't do it that way, because biblical principles would direct us in a different direction. I was talking to somebody yesterday for a couple, let me see, was it Tuesday? Yeah, Tuesday. We talked for several hours. And he was saying how his previous church had shrunk from 375 to 75, which happens. Sometimes it can happen because the pastor is faithful. That happens. In fact, if many pastors would be more faithful, a lot of churches would shrink. Let's just keep it real. But this case, seemingly, from what I understood, that wasn't the case here. The preacher was taking every criticism to heart. The old people wanted older hymns. The young people wanted no hymns. Everybody wanted it their way. And he took it all to heart and created a big problem. So how do you know if you take it to heart, or let me put it this way, how do you know if you listen to it or you don't? How do you know whether you use your good ear or your bad ear? Well, you have to ask yourself the question, is that which I'm criticized for biblical, or else is it derived from biblical principles that I cannot abandon and maintain a good conscience? And brethren, if that's the case, if it's built on biblical principles, biblical text and or principles, then let the criticism come. And just go back to verse 21. Do not take to heart everything people say. Observation number 3, we need to be cautious in giving criticism. I think this is an important lesson from verses 21 and 2. Both from 21 and 22. If we're not to take heed or take to heart everything people say, every criticism people level, then that implies we need to be cautious ourselves in leveling criticism. And of course, verse 22, if we're at times guilty of hypercriticism, then we need to be careful how we criticize. You have to ask yourself these questions. Question number one. Is my criticism true, or is it merely my opinion / preference? Secondly, is it something that needs mentioning? It can just be, you know what, I wouldn't do it that way, but you know what, I don't always have to have it my way. Why do we have to sing four hymns, not six? Why two projected and two from the hymn book? Why can't we read more than one chapter? Why do we have to read a whole chapter? Why do you pray so long? Why can't you have a 40-minute sermon? More illustrations, please. Brother, you can imagine the criticism. You have to ask yourself, is this something that's just my opinion / preference? And or is it something that I have to say? Maybe I can just keep some of my criticisms to myself. That's a possibility. And thirdly, why am I telling this to others? If I have a concern or criticism, why not, one, keep it to myself if it doesn't match the first two questions? And if it's something that I have to say, then why not say it to the person that I'm criticizing, or why do I have to say it to somebody else? Do not take to heart everything people say. And if you do, you're going to be prone or open to hearing all manner of things, even from those close to you, lest you hear your servant cursing you. All right, now let me close with three helps. One, unjust criticism is sin. These are helps for us to be cautious in our criticism. Unjust criticism is sin. It's a violation of the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Again, unjust criticism. Criticism that's just your opinion. Criticism that's just your preference. Criticism that doesn't need to be said and or told to the wrong people is called gossip. Unjust criticism. I didn't say criticism is sin. That would violate 12, 15 minutes of what I've said. Unjust criticism is sin, and it's devilish. I'm going to show you that in a second. Secondly, unjust criticism is harmful. By this I mean it creates unjust and unloving thoughts in the minds of others. One, it's unloving toward the person that you're unjustly criticizing. But it's also harmful and detrimental to others to whom you may share these criticisms. Envision this wretched sight. Driving home, and the parents begin to let in. Everything that went wrong today at church, or everything that happened at church, was said at church that they don't like. Pastor Mike got new shoes. His prayer's long. Miss Johnson's hair needs dyed. Or maybe she dyed it. Brother, you think that doesn't happen? And what do the children think when they hear all this criticism? You know what it does? It breeds in them distrust of those criticized. One of the worst things you can do to your children is that. Stuff in their ears unjust criticism week in, week out. Guess what's going to happen? They're going to become little self-righteous Pharisees who are going to look down their nose at everybody around them because they are not like my mom and dad. Brother, never criticize somebody in front of your children. There's rare exceptions where that needs to happen. it's probably best to just be quiet. If it's just your opinion and it's not necessary and you're not speaking to the right person. I understand that we can be a little open perhaps with our spouses, but you have to be careful there too. The Bible talks a lot about gossip, talks a lot about slander. And before I come to the last help, I want to show you something of the severity of it from a passage you know. Look at James 3. And it's really the whole chapter, but we'll just pick up at verse 8. No man can tame the tongue. Well, I do want to read verse 6. I'm sorry. Let's back up to verse 6. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it's set on fire by hell. That's what I meant when I said it's devilish. For every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. You're killing those kids, Mom and Dad. Killing them slowly. Deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Finally, unjust criticism is potentially very common. And let me just say, I think most of us struggle with it. Solomon thinks so. Maybe you're the exception. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. Unjust criticism is a sin that serious, harmful, and tragically, brethren, common, at least potentially. And thus we have to have wisdom that protects the soul. And that takes us back to verse 19. Wisdom strengthens the wise. Where are you going to get the grace, brethren, not to be a critic? Well, remember what we've seen. You're not going to find it inside yourself. You can only find it, and brethren, you can find it in abundance, in Christ, where you'll also find blood to atone for all your iniquities. And that includes your sins of hyper-criticism.